You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you, and welcome to our program. It is Friday, so, of course, the first hour of our program every Friday is the man I think of as America's senator, although the proud citizens of Vermont are very pleased to have him as their senator, Senator Bernie Sanders, and Bernie will be taking your calls right after our brief conversation here about the issues of the day. Senator, welcome to the program.
Great to be with you, Tom.
Great to have you. So what's on your agenda, Bernie?
Well, there is a whole lot of stuff going on, and let me just briefly go through a few of the issues. There is national discussion now about the war on poverty, because it was about 50 years ago, exactly 50 years ago, that Lyndon Johnson announced his war on poverty. And I think we take for granted today so much that was in the legislation that followed his speech, that we sometimes, I think, forget about the importance of some of that legislation. What Johnson did is provide health insurance to all seniors as a guaranteed right through Medicare. And Medicare today is an extremely popular and, needless to say, extremely important program that provides quality health insurance and prescription drugs for millions and millions of seniors. That was part of the war on poverty. Medicaid was part of the war on poverty. And while Medicaid continues to struggle with lower reimbursement rates than it should, it has been a lifeline for tens and tens, I think so over 70 million children and working people and lower income people who before Medicaid had no place to turn when they needed to go to the doctor, when they needed to go to the hospital, and Medicaid provides that care. The war on poverty brought forth food stamps. Again, we take food stamps for granted today, and we debate how much we should be spending. But that was a declaration by Johnson and the Congress of 50 years ago that nobody in America should go hungry. And that was not always the case. And we have a long way to go, but the fact that right now we provide assistance to people when they otherwise would be hungry is nothing to minimize. The Older Americans Act brought forth the concept, War on Poverty brought forth the concept of the Community Health Center program, something which I've been very active in. And that now provides primary health care and dental care and low-cost prescription drugs and mental health counseling to somewhere around 24 million Americans in every state in this country. So when you see a community health center, understand that that idea germinated from the war on poverty. The Older Americans Act and the Meals on Wheels program and support for community, and support for senior centers all over this country came from the war on poverty. So the bottom line here is that, in my view, the war on poverty has been very, very successful in protecting the lives and the well-being of tens and tens and tens of millions of Americans. Can we do better? Absolutely. Are there some programs that should be improved? No question about it. But what we should not forget is that when the war on poverty was initiated in the mid-1960s, the economy was fairly strong. And yet at that point, the poverty rate was 19.5%. Today, as a result of the Wall Street collapse, the economy is not strong, and yet poverty is at 15%, much higher than we want it to be, but less than it was when the program was initiated in the 1960s. And what economists tell us, poverty rate today without the war on poverty programs would be at 29%.
Wow.
So last point that I would make on that issue is that if we look at what we have done as a nation compared to many other countries in Europe or Scandinavia, we should appreciate that we have yet a long way to go. Poverty rate for children in this country, 21.5%, much higher than other countries around the world. In fact, the highest in the industrialized world. In terms of maternity leave and the kind of benefits you get when you're having a baby, we are far behind most of the rest of the world. In terms of retirement benefits, we are behind many other countries. So in terms of establishing a strong safety net for vulnerable people, the war on poverty took us a significant step forward, and Johnson deserves a lot of credit for that. I know, you know, that as a president, he is much maligned for the war on Vietnam. But people, I think, forget about the enormously important role he played in pushing and using his legislative skills as a president, former majority leader, and getting that legislation passed, which is improving the lives of millions and millions and millions of people. So that is an issue I think you're going to be hearing a lot about in the coming weeks. Other issue out there, obviously, is the issue of extending emergency unemployment benefits for 1.3 million Americans who have just lost those benefits at the end of the year. The issue here is that while the unemployment numbers are going down slowly, real unemployment today remains at 13%, and there are many states in the country where it is much higher than that. Long-term unemployment is very, very, very high. In fact, it is higher than it has been, I believe, in the last 50 years. And that means that people who lose their jobs are remaining unemployed for 6 months or longer at far higher levels than we have seen for a very long time. Now, the politics of this business is that when Bush was president and we extended unemployment benefits for the long-term unemployed, Bush and the Republicans at that point did not call for offsets. They understood that we had an emergency situation and they voted appropriately. Now that Obama is president, suddenly they want offsets. And many of the offsets that they are looking at are very, very bad offsets. So to help protect the families of long-term unemployed, they want to cut health care benefits. Or they are interested in bringing forward a Keystone pipeline or some other piece of legislation which has nothing to do with the issue at hand. So we're going to focus on that. It's very imperative that we pass an extension of these long-term unemployed benefits on behalf of 1.3 million workers and their families. It's also important for the economy because if these folks don't have, and the average amount that they get is all of $300 a week, but that $300 is life and death to a whole lot of folks. And if they don't have that money to spend, the economists tell us we'll lose approximately 200,000 jobs, and GDP will decline in the coming year by about 0.2%. So this is an issue that was discussed last week. It will be back in discussion again next week. Another issue that I know many people are concerned about is the Trans-Pacific Partnership, the so-called TPP, and the issue of a fast track on that. I am very, very strongly opposed to fast track. And what fast track means is that members of Congress cannot provide amendments, cannot improve the legislation that comes to us. And it's an expedited process to get this thing passed. as you and I have discussed for many, many years, trade policy in this country, whether it's NAFTA, CAFTA, permanent normal trade relations with China, has kind of led to a race to the bottom. American workers are forced to compete with desperate people all over the world, and one of the trade partners in a TPP would be Vietnam, where the minimum wage there is 28 cents an hour. And I am not sure that it is in the best interest of American workers to be competing against people who make all of 28 cents an hour. So I think this is an issue we got to focus on. I am not sympathetic to it, and I am certainly not sympathetic to a fast-track proposal which expedites it.
Senator Bernie Sanders with us. It's our Brunch with Bernie Hour. Your calls for Senator Bernie Sanders coming up next right here on the Tom Hartman Program. And be sure to check out Bernie's website, sanders.senate.gov. You can sign up for the Bernie Buzz there, his newsletter.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Also at sanders.senate.gov, you'll find the news of the day. It's a great news aggregation site. We put a lot of work into that site. It's worth checking out. We'll be right back. And welcome back. And Paul in South Lyon, Michigan, watching Free Speech TV on the Dish TV satellite network. You're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Yeah, thanks for your service to the country, Senator.
Thank you, Paul.
The Republicans, led by Ayn Rand, Paul, think money from the government is a disservice to people, and that's a quote. So let's stop doing a disservice to the Republicans and cut off their government paychecks for their do-nothing jobs and criminals. I'm an economist. Can you pass along some economic facts? Paying unemployment benefits and raising the minimum wage pay for themselves in increased economic activity. The three-month extension of unemployment benefits costs roughly $5 billion. This adds $10 billion to the economy from the economic multiplier effect, which is a well-known economic fact. And when the government collects taxes on this $10 billion in economic activity, it adds up to $4 billion in the first year. And in the following years, the government makes a profit by paying unemployment benefits through increased taxes in the long term. But the Republicans are too economic illiterate and short-sighted to see this.
Well, Paul, thank you very much, and I agree with what you said. Investing in people in the long run is cost-effective. It's humane, obviously. It eases suffering. Imagine somebody who is 50 or 55 years of age who is out there month after month desperately looking for work, and now their unemployment stops. What happens to them and their family? So from a human point of view, it's the right thing to do. But the point that Paul is making, and I tried to make a moment ago, is that when these folks have that $300 a week on average to spend, they're spending it in their communities. And in doing that, they create jobs. Without that money, the economists tell us that we would lose about 200,000 jobs a year and see a decline in our GDP by 0.2%. That's the point that Paul is making. In terms of minimum wage, I think it's the same principle. One way that we could actually cut the deficit when we raise the minimum wage is stop subsidizing companies like Walmart or Burger King or McDonald's, who pay very often the federal minimum wage, which is $7.25 an hour, or maybe just a little bit more for that. And what happens when you have working people in McDonald's or at Walmart or Burger King or other fast food restaurants, how do they survive? Well, in order to survive when you're earning those low wages, you need to get Medicaid, you need to get food stamps, you need to get government-subsidized housing. And they need all of these federal taxpayer-supported programs because their employers are paying them starvation wages. And the point that Paul is making, which is an absolute right point, is if you raise the minimum wage, then the government doesn't have to provide those services. If you extend unemployment benefits, it ends up paying for itself through an economic multiplier. So Paul's point is, in my view, absolutely correct.
These guys obviously know this because they extended these things during the Bush administration. Could it be that they're just trying to crash the economy because Obama's president?
Well, I think what it is, you have seen in the last several years a real movement to the right on the part of the Republican Party, and that is being pushed heavily by folks like the Koch brothers and some other billionaire campaign contributors.
So you think many of them are just dancing to the tune of
ideology? After the break.
Okay. All right. We'll be right back. It's 20 minutes past the hour here on the Tom Hartman program. It's our Brunch with Bernie hour. Senator Bernie Sanders taking your calls right after this. Where despair is not an option. Get out there, get active, the Tom Hartman program. It's our Brunch with Bernie hour. And, Senator, we were just talking a moment ago about unemployment insurance and how the multiplier effect, basically when you pay out unemployment insurance, it really doesn't cost the government anything because it stimulates the economy. And I pointed out that the Republicans, when Bush was president, seemed to understand this because they passed it over and over and over again. Could it be that, you know, is it ideology or is it partisanship? Could it be that they're actually trying to hurt the economy in order to hurt the Obama administration?
Well, I think it's maybe a little bit of both, but it's certainly ideological in the sense that the Republicans have now moved much further to the right than where they were in previous years. And when you are led by people like the Koch brothers and others who believe absolutely that programs like Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid, the Environmental Protection Agency, the concept of the minimum wage, that all of these programs should either be eliminated completely and privatized or significantly cut, then you are living in a different world than we were a few years ago. So there are folks out there who believe that the idea of unemployment insurance itself is not a good idea, let alone extending it. So you have a Republican Party now dominated by billionaire interests, right-wing interests, who have a very different role in terms of what government should be doing than was the case 5 or even 10 years ago.
Yeah, okay. Walter in Tempe, Arizona. You're on the air with Senator Sanders. Walter? Oh, maybe Walter has his phone on mute.
Senator Sanders and Tom, thank you for so much that you do for all of us. I'm just wondering, how is it that everyone I speak with, be it liberals or conservatives or anywhere in between, all want money out of politics, yet you don't hear many of the politicians talking about actual reform? How do we change that?
Well, Walter, let me talk about it. Here's one politician who does talk about it. I think that the kind of the flood of money, the torrential flood of money into politics today is undermining the very foundations of American democracy. So when we talk about any issue that's out there, you talk about health care, you talk about education, you talk about the economy, you talk about climate change, talk about women's rights, talk about any of those issues, all of which are enormously important. What is even more important in terms of the political process is the role that money is playing in politics today. And that started years ago, but it was certainly, it's always been a factor. But citizens, this disastrous Citizens United Supreme Court decision of 3 years ago just completely opened the floodgates of money. And now what we're looking at in American politics today is you can have tens of millions of people who feel strongly about an issue. And then you've got on the other side of that issue a handful of billionaire families who are able to provide huge financial support to the candidates that represent their interests. These very same individuals were able to open up all of these think tanks, own media, play a role way, way, way out of proportion to their numbers. And I can give you a dozen examples. Let me give you one. Every poll that I have seen says that the American people, whether they're Democrats, whether they're Republicans, whether they're independents, whether they're progressives, whether they're conservatives, you know what? They do not want to see Social Security cut. They don't want to see Medicare cut. They don't want to see Medicaid cut. And you know what, by the way? Many of those people want to see the wealthiest people and largest corporations pay more in taxes. That's what the American people believe. Then you go to Capitol Hill and you see a whole different dynamic which has been created by billionaires and right-wing think tanks and their lobbyists. And that dynamic is, oh, of course we have to cut Social Security and Medicare and Medicaid. Oh, of course we have to protect all of the loopholes that corporations receive, one out of four of which does not pay any federal taxes at all. That's the logic within Washington and inside the Beltway, and yet the world looks very, very different outside the Beltway. And that is precisely because of money in politics. It is bad. It is getting worse. Billionaires sit in a room, literally sit in a room. They said, oh, yeah, who are we going to support? Who are we going to put hundreds of millions of dollars into? So unless we get a handle on that, A, by overturning Citizens United, and B, by moving to public funding of elections, democracy in this country is under real severe attack.
Right, and we can't do B until we do A.
Right.
Yeah. Ken, in Silver City, New Mexico, listening on KABQ, you're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Hey, Senator. Question here. I'd like to find out about reversing privatization. Tom always rants about how the NSA should not be privatized and a few other things. But if you take all the people that are privatized now in the government, whether it be NSA, whether it be defense, whether it be all the rest of it, and I think that that I heard before that Edward Snowden was making $200,000 a year. If you took those, reversed it, and made them government jobs at $60,000 or $70,000 a year, you could add three people for every one Edward Snowden, and you could rehire the Edward Snowden plus another two. You don't have to go back to Congress for a nickel. The funds are already there. Cutting up contracts, they don't have any problems as far as cutting up contracts for unions and all the rest of these things. Why can't you reprivatize and go back to making government jobs instead of these private jobs. And if you took a look at all of them,
we're going to hit the break here.
Thanks for the question. It's a good question. And when you were speaking, something came into my mind. I was remembering I was in Afghanistan a few years ago, and we were in one of these heavy-duty security vehicles. And there were two guys. Well, we'll pick this up, I guess, after the break.
Yeah, we'll pick it up after the break. And, okay. And this is a great topic. It is our Brunch with Bernie Hour. Senator Bernie Sanders taking your calls here on the Tom Hartman Program. Your opportunity to participate in our National City Hall, held every week right here on this program with Senator Bernie Sanders. Be right back.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
And be sure to check out Bernie's website at sanders.senate.gov. Back, Tom Hartman here with you. It's our Brunch with Bernie Hour. Senator Bernie Sanders on the line taking your calls. And Senator Sanders, we were on a topic just as we hit the break.
Right. Walter talked about the need to reverse privatization, and I largely agree with him. And I was mentioning that when I was in Afghanistan a few years ago, I was being driven around in Kabul by two guys. One was driving and one was on the passenger seat carrying an automatic rifle. And one guy was in the U.S. military, and the other guy was a private contractor. They were both doing exactly the same work. One was being paid, to Walter's point, significantly more than the other guy. And you're seeing that all over governmental programs and agencies, where the private sector people, in many cases, are being paid a lot more than people who work for the United States government. So I think if his point is that we can save a lot of money and in some ways improve the quality of our services, I think he's right.
Judy in Hot Springs Village, Arkansas. You're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Oh, Senator Sanders, hold on. Let me get off speaker here. Senator Sanders, thanks for taking my call. I received a reply from Senator John Boozman of Arkansas regarding country of origin labeling. He came back and he referred to this as an agreement under the WTO, called it the COOL, COOL, said that we had tried that, but we subsequently were sued by Canada and Mexico because they determined their products would receive less favorable status to U.S. consumers. This tells me that U.S. consumers prefer to buy American, and don't these fair trade agreements that allow not only one country to sue another, but hinders consumers from knowing the country of origin and prevents us from buying U.S.-made goods, beef or food or whatever, which would stimulate job growth here?
Judy, I think you're exactly right. I think people have a right to know. It would seem pretty elemental that people have a right to know where the product that they are purchasing is made. And they have a right to know because in some cases, say if it's an agricultural product, they feel a lot more confident about regulations in the United States than in maybe Mexico or China or someplace else, and they want good quality food. But if it's another product, they also are interested in stimulating their own economy and making sure that people in our own country have decent paying jobs. Do people have a right to have that information? Well, I certainly do think that they should. But I think you're touching on now these trade agreements that in a dozen different ways, that being just one part of the concern, make it harder and harder for people in a country to have the kind of protections that they should be entitled to. So your concern, I think, is legitimate, and that is why I have been very strongly in opposition to these trade agreements that come down the pike.
Wayne in Chicago, you're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Yeah, let me cut the speakerphone. Okay, yes, good afternoon. But it's not a good afternoon for those 1.3 million people who've been thrown under the bus by the Republicans. I refuse to extend unemployment insurance. But I just want to make another comment. How is it that a Democratic president would push for a trade deal that's an absolute disaster for America? It doesn't make any sense. That's something that a Republican would do. I mean, it seems like this president just wants to do anything just so long as I make a deal. It doesn't matter if I backstab American people in the back, as long as I make a deal. So let me just say this. Here's my prediction. If the Democrats don't stand up and start having a spine and doing what's right, I think that guy was Deval Patrick at the Democratic Convention who said they need to stand up and have a spine. They're going to lose the Senate, and they're also going to lose the House in 2016. Now, I want to get back to unemployment. What I want to ask the senator is there a legal way, if the Republicans in the House defeat the unemployment insurance, if it passes the Senate, first of all, are there legal maneuvers to ensure that these unemployed people can get their money? And I'll hang up and listen.
Well, I wouldn't use the word legal. There are political maneuvers that one can use. If one places a very, very high priority on extending unemployment benefits and say to the Republicans that, you know what, we ain't going home until these benefits are extended. And if you want A, B, and C, you're not going to get it until we have these benefits. That's the way it can we can prevail on this. We've got to make them an offer that they can't refuse. We've got to rally the American people, and legislatively, we've got to put this on legislation which must be passed. So that's the answer to that question. In terms of the politics of this whole business and Democrats having a spine, Wayne, I agree with you. I mean, I've been saying this for years. You have had a segment of the Democratic Party who think that success is becoming what we call Republican light, and that is trying to emulate the Republicans, not being as far to the right, clearly, but just, you know, trying to develop some kind of mushy ground where they're pro-business and occasionally they pay attention to working families. I just think that if they maintain that policy, and if they don't begin to stand up forcefully and clearly for working families in this country, at a time when the middle class is disappearing, we have more people living in poverty than any time in the history of America, if they are not prepared to take on the big money interests who have so much economic and political power, I agree with you. I think the American people will sit there and say, what's the difference? Why should I even bother to vote? It doesn't matter. Both parties are working against my interests. So I think Wayne makes a very important point on that. And then he talks about the TPP, the Trans-Pacific Partnership. And he's asking why it is that a Democratic president like Obama would be supportive of that. Well, I have to tell you that when you look at what goes on in Washington and why so many people are contemptuous of both political parties and of the political process in D.C., it has a lot to do with trade policies. And I would tell you that the president that signed NAFTA, that wasn't a Republican president, that was Bill Clinton. And on all of these issues, on trade policies, there have been Democratic presidents and Republican presidents and Democratic Congresses and Republican Congresses working together. And I think that's a sad state of affairs. My strong hope is that in terms of this TPP, we will have a number of Democrats and some Republicans as well who have the courage to stand up for working families, to say, don't ship my job to Vietnam. Allow me, as the previous caller indicated, to know what is in, where the product is manufactured. Don't allow corporations to overturn legislation protecting the environmental standards of our country or what states are doing. So I hope we can rally Congress, and I will tell you that I think there is more and more opposition to these trade agreements than was previously the case, because people can see the impact in terms of the decline of manufacturing. They can see the impact in terms of the race to the bottom and the lowering of wages for American workers. I will end my comment by saying that last year or so, there was a statement made by somebody from General Electric, and GE had broadened manufacturing, and I think it was Louisville, Kentucky, and they had added some hundreds of jobs in. That was the good news. Bad news is that the jobs that these workers were being paid were significantly less than what older workers were making. And the reason the guy said that they were able to expand in Kentucky, and this is true not just in Kentucky but all over America, is because when wages go down in America, we, quote-unquote, become more competitive with China. That's called the race to the bottom, and that's what these trade agreements have accomplished.
Morris in Long Beach, California, listening on KPFK. You're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Hello, Mr. Sanders. I simply wanted to bring to everyone's attention that since the Bush tax cuts went into play, $1 trillion that should make the U.S. Treasury each year does not make the U.S. Treasury. And as a result, the United States government doesn't have any money to even enforce the law. For example, down in West Virginia, you have 9 counties that cannot drink any other water. And I think that's due to the fact that the government can't enforce any of the regulatory laws that are on the books. My hope would be that the United States would go back to the era of Ike Eisenhower, his tax codes, giving the government more money, and also follow his advice regarding the military being curtailed. I'll take my comments off the air. And
thank you, Morris. Well, we have 1 minute.
Thank you very much for that powerful and cogent comment. And I think you're right on all counts. I voted against the reauthorization of the Defense Department because, among other things, several other things, I thought the budget was much, much too large. And I made the point, I quoted from what Eisenhower had said in his farewell address, that every dollar, now, Tom, you play that on the radio occasionally, don't you?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah.
That every dollar spent on the military is a dollar taken away from human needs and children and so forth and so on. And what Eisenhower said way back in 1960 is as true today as it was then. So I think that this issue of defense spending is one issue that we certainly have got to pay a lot more attention to than we have in recent years.
15 minutes before the hour, we'll be right back with Senator Bernie Sanders.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
And be sure to check out Bernie's website at sanders.senate.gov and sign up for the Bernie Buzz thing. Welcome back.
Morris also asked me about taxes and tax rates and under Eisenhower and so forth. And again, he makes a very appropriate point. 1 out of 4 corporations do not pay any federal taxes today, and collectively, corporate taxes are significantly less than they used to be. Furthermore, while we did repeal Bush's tax breaks for the top 1%, we did not repeal them for other wealthier people. And Morris's point is that when you talk about the deficit and you talk about the budget, a key factor is not just what you spend, which is what Republicans talk about, but the other part of it is how much revenue comes in. And in fact, Morris is quite right. We are losing substantial sums of money by retaining Bush's tax breaks for the wealthy, and we should repeal them.
Okay. Let's see here. Robert in Ironwood, Michigan, watching Free Speech TV on the Dish Satellite Network. You're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Hello, Tom, and Senator Sanders.
Hi.
It was kind of similar to the last couple questions. I was wanted to ask, with these programs of TARP and QE1 and QE2 and the bailouts and subsidies to corporations, Bernie, do you feel that this is all corporate welfare, and is there a way that we can possibly shame these corporations into paying their fair share?
I think there is, Robert. I think the American people are profoundly disgusted and sick and tired of the greed that they have seen from Wall Street and corporate America. We just had an example right now in the state of Washington, where Boeing, a very profitable corporation, has threatened that if workers there do not take a reduction in their pension program, they're going to move out of state. Time after time after time, workers are being confronted with a choice about giving up health care benefits or lower wages or else their company is threatening to move to China or to Mexico. Wall Street, which was bailed out by the middle class and working families of this country, is now enjoying record-breaking profits. And then they send people to Washington, D.C. to say, oh, well, yeah, thanks. We Wall Street executives get huge retirement benefits. We get huge salaries. But we think you should cut Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid. That's good for the country. Are the American people sick and tired of corporate welfare? Are they sick and tired of the growing gap between the very, very rich and everybody else? Are they sick and tired of billionaires putting money into the political process to help destroy the American middle class? Yeah, I think the American people are sick and tired of that. And we have just got to educate. We have got to organize. We've got to demand that people who we send to Washington or to the state legislature start sticking up for the endangered middle class and working families, the people who are really struggling and have the guts to take on the big money interests whose greed is helping to destroy the American economy.
Yeah, we just have about 20 seconds. I frequently say it's not the Bush tax cuts we have to worry about, it's the Reagan tax cuts. Your thoughts on that?
Well, I mean, obviously this ideology, started off big time with Reagan, and what Bush did is part of a continuation of what Reagan started.
Senator Bernie Sanders, we'll be right back with more of your questions for Bernie. Welcome back. Tom Harbin here with you. It's our Brunch with Bernie Hour. Senator Bernie Sanders on the line taking your calls. David in Mounds, Oklahoma. You're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Oh, thank you, Tom. It's good to talk to you in the center. As a progressive in Oklahoma, let's get back to this affordable health care. My wife and I signed up on her. I'm going to be 65 when we get on Medicare in February. She had to sign up on this, and we got an affordable health care program, and we picked a plan. The plan is I'm going to have to pay $300 a month. My wife is fairly healthy. She's 60 years old. But when we went to the doctor, she went to the doctor and got a physical. And it paid for that, but she wanted to do some more tests, and the insurance will not pay for nothing other than preventive health care. Everything we get that we have to go to the doctor for, that she wants to do tests for, if it's not preventive, we have to pay up to $3,000 before that, for the insurance pays anything. And I just can't afford it on a fixed income. Do you have something to say about that?
Let me just say this, David. Obviously, I'm not familiar with the program in Oklahoma that your wife selected. It sounds to me like you probably have one with a high deductible and maybe less expensive than some other programs. My view, I voted for the Affordable Care Act, and I think it is a step forward in terms of ending this obscenity of pre-existing conditions. It makes it easier for young people to stay on their parents' insurance program. We have significantly expanded Medicaid to people who otherwise would not be eligible for Medicaid. I work very hard to expand community health centers all over this country. And in a number of instances, people are going to get better quality health care at lower cost than they otherwise would have been able to get. But having said all of that, I think we have got to go further, and I think, actually, I'm chairman of a subcommittee which deals with these issues, and ask a very simple question is why we are the only nation on earth that doesn't guarantee health care to all people as a right, and why we end up spending almost twice as much per person on health care as other people of other nations whose outcomes are often better. So what I'm saying to you, David, is there are zillions of different programs. You know, you have one in Oklahoma and somebody will have one in Vermont, and I think what we have to do is and I'm glad that you're going to be eligible for Medicare soon, and I think that what we have to do is take the concept of Medicare and expand it to everybody in this country. I think if you're talking about cost-effective, quality health care, a Medicare-for-all single-payer system so that the people in Oklahoma are getting the same health care as the people in Vermont, and I think we can provide that health care at a lot lower cost than what we are presently doing, because right now the private insurance companies have enormous power over the process, and their goal is not cost-effective quality care. It's making as much money as they can. So that would be my response.
Dion in Waterford Works, New Jersey, watching on our YouTube channel. You're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Hello, Senator Sanders. First of all, I want to thank you for giving a voice to the people who can't afford to buy one. My question is regarding the Trans-Pacific Partnership, and with the current issue with unemployment and everything, and the extension being an issue now, considering that the Trans-Pacific Partnership is basically NAFTA on steroids, isn't this just going to be a huge problem down the line?
Dion, I tend to agree with you. Yeah, I do. This is, in fact, as you know, it's a trade agreement between 12 countries, which represent 38% of the entire global economy. So this is a huge, huge trade agreement. And I have the same concerns and even more with this particular agreement, A, because of its size, B, because it has been negotiated virtually in secret, C, because it gives enormous powers for corporations over national governments and local governments all over the world. So I worry very much that this is an agreement written by the leading corporations of the world. I think it will benefit them, and I think it will be a continuation of the policy of driving the wages down in the United States and continuing this race to the bottom, which has been so harmful to our economy. So I share your concerns.
Senator, we have 2 minutes. You want to take another call, or do you want to...
Let's do one more call.
Okay. Sydney in Pollock, Louisiana. You're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Mr. Sanders, on our cost of living raises, when you give me a 1% raise on my $12,000, that's $120 a year, and a man making $100,000 at the top end of the pay scale for the government is getting $1,000. Now, did the cost of living go up $1,000 or $120?
Well, in terms of Social Security, you got a 1.5% increase, which I think underestimates the purchasing needs and the inflation that seniors have experienced. And one of the things that we are trying to do is not only prevent cuts, Sydney, to Social Security and Medicare and Medicaid, but to come up with an index that adequately reflects inflation in terms of the purchasing policies, practices of seniors. So we want to make sure that you get more. But one thing I do want to tell you, Sydney, you may complain, and you're right, that the 1.5% COLA is inadequate. We had to fight very, very hard and to rally the American people to make sure that Social Security was not cut, Medicare was not cut, Medicaid was not cut. So we're going to work hard to come up with a fairer way to bring forth and determine what a COLA should be.
Okay. We got to say that again? Oh, 15 seconds. Okay.
All right. Well, let me just conclude the program today thanking all of the callers, wishing everybody a happy new year, and to tell everybody there are some huge issues coming before the Congress. People have got to be involved. They've got to get on the phone. They've got to start emailing, and they got to start making this Congress represent and work for the middle class of this country and not just the top 1%.
Bernie, thank you for continually reminding us of the importance of activism. It is so great. Thanks, and thanks so much for being with us.
Okay, my pleasure. Take care.
Thank you. Senator Sanders. We'll be back with Anything Goes Friday here on the Tom Hartman.
You're listening to Tom Hartman.
Hey, friends, Tom Hartman here. Thanks so much for watching and listening to the program. The Tom Hartman program is brought to you in part by the following underwriters. EdisonFactor.com. EdisonFactor is a supplement for the brain. More information at EdisonFactor.com. SolarWorld.com. SolarWorld has a 35-year history in the manufacturing of solar in America. More information at SolarWorld.com. Carbonite.com. Automatic online backup and file recovery. More information at Carbonite.com. AngiesList.com. Detailed reviews on roofers, plumbers, house cleaners, dentists, and more. More information at AngiesList.com. Stamps.com. Postage online from your computer. More information at Stamps.com. And our website, TomHartmann.com. You support our programs, and please help by supporting the people who help make this program possible. There are links to all of our underwriters at TomHartmann.com. Thank you.
You're listening to the Tom Hartmann Program.
Welcome back. Tom Hartmann here with you. 7 minutes past the hour. It's Anything Goes Friday. And I have to share with you a comment that Bernie made before we went on the air. I'm sure he won't mind my sharing this, I picked up the phone and I said, "Hi, how are you?" And I said, "What do you think of this Chris Christie stuff?" And he said, "It's gossip." He said, "There's real problems in this nation we need to be talking about." And it just like really hit me. Wow. It's like, this is the state of our media now. And I'll cop to it that, you know, I spent an hour on Chris Christie yesterday and there are people who are losing their unemployment right now. So anyhow, it's like, this is the state of our media. They're not reporting on unemployment. They're not telling the stories of, you know, what is happening to the unemployed. They're not telling the stories of what's happening to people whose unemployment has run out. They're not telling the stories of people whose jobs have been shipped offshore because of trade deals. And yesterday, this piece of legislation dropped in the House and the Senate that would fast track the Trans-Pacific Partnership, TPP. We need to figure out a way, by the way, with TPP to get Haiti, except they're not in the Pacific. Honduras, I don't think they have a Pacific port. Some country that starts with H in there, because there's Singapore, and then you could call it SHAFTA, the Singapore-Haiti Free Trade Agreement, right? So you'd have NAFTA, CAFTA, and SHAFTA. Anyway, bad joke. But this is not being discussed in our media. I mean, these are the real issues. So, anyway, but there's a lot going on, and whatever may be on your mind today, and I'll share bits and pieces of what's on my mind as we continue through the day. I'm also curious, anybody who saw, I brought this up at the last half hour of yesterday's program, and so we just kind of started to touch on it. But on Wednesday, when I was my lungs were on fire, waiting for the antibiotics to kick in, I'm a member of SAG-AFTRA, the union, the Screen Actors Guild, and so I get these DVDs for the SAG Awards, you know, to look at the movies, to vote on the movies, you know, it's sort of like the Academy Awards kind of thing, like SAG, and I got a copy of 12 Years a Slave, and I watched it. Louise and I watched it together on Wednesday at home. And I thought it was a brilliant and powerful movie, and I thought it raised a lot of issues that went beyond just slavery. Issues of misogyny, issues of power, issues of power relationships, issues of employment. I think it's important for us to remember that slavery did not, you know, it was not invented in the United States, that the Romans had, you know, the Roman Empire rested on slavery, the Greeks rested on slavery, that, you know, slavery was justified during, you find, you know, Paul in the Bible saying, treat your slaves well, 2,000 years ago, you know, well, that was the Roman Empire back then, but, you know, basically, it's been around for 7,000 years, you had slaves during the Sumerian times. So, you know, the question, do we still have, you know, some variation on slavery that is not as violent and brutal in some ways? Although I would argue that, you know, somebody dying of hypothermia in a ditch because they have, you know, they're homeless and they've got no place to go and just dying, freezing, huddling there, hungry and cold, you know, it may not seem as violent as being whipped to death by the plantation owner, but it's still somebody dying. There's still an element of violence and brutality involved in that. And that's in our system today in the United States. So, anyway, watching the movie raised a lot of very interesting questions in my mind. And the whole we versus me society thing, the Ayn Rand thing, comports very, very well with a society that holds slaves. Whether they're literal chattel property slaves, as in the slavery that we had in this country over 100 years ago, or whether they are wage slaves, as Ayn Rand advocates in her books Atlas Shrugged, where you've got, you know, Dabney, who inherited her daddy's railroad and you know, is going at it with the union guys. John Galt, who says, you know, we're going to go off and start our own paradise where we don't need any of these pesky working people. Right. We're going to learn to clean our own toilets. Right. So anyway, Anything Goes Friday. Cooper in Kremling, Colorado. Hey, Cooper, thanks for listening to AM 760. What's on your mind?
Hello, Mr. Hartman. I wanted to say one thing. We need to push for a surge in the war on poverty. And also, I wanted to, I have to tell you, I heard, you know, the conversation you had with that gentleman earlier in the week about Thomas Jefferson, and he said, and his view was that because God created men, that evolution could not exist. And I think if you have that view, you kind of have a very simple view of a complex consciousness and a very complex universe that that consciousness created. You know, to me, the miracle of evolution is much more impressive than some being just snapping his fingers and here we are.
So. I agree. And the argument that he was making, that anybody who believed in evolution was not fit for public office, and then suggesting that, you know, Jefferson would agree with that, was just totally bizarre.
Yeah, absolutely. I got
So anyway, did you have a question, or do you just wanted to share that comment?
I just wanted to share that comment. You know, I wanted to say, you know, that we need to push for a surge in the war on poverty, and I don't know how to get that message out. I was going to ask Bernie Sanders about that, but obviously ran out of time.
Yeah. Well, I think, you know, Bernie's answer, he says it every day, you know, every day that he's on, over and over again. We need to organize. We need to get to active. We need to show up. We need to participate. This politics is not a spectator sport. You've got to get involved. Cooper, thanks a lot for the call. Great to hear from you. Corey in St. Clair Shores, Michigan, watching on YouTube. Hey, Corey, what's up?
Hi, thank you. My question is, if the NSA has been spying on Congress and the Supreme Court for years, why do we still consider this federal government legitimate?
Well, it's actually a very good question, Corey, and there's a very, very serious aspect to that, and let me riff on that for a second. The Constitution clearly divides the three branches of government. The Article 1 is the legislative, the first among equals. Article 2 is the executive, the president and all these cabinet offices and all the police powers of government. That's all in Article 2. That's under the executive. And the lawmakers, the legislative, has no police powers. And then Article 3 is the judicial, the judiciary. And they have no police powers either. They have no enforcement mechanisms. In fact, in Federalist number 81, I think, or 80, Alexander Hamilton talks about how the judiciary is the least injurious because they have neither the power of the purse, Article 1, nor the power of police, Article 2, or of the army. But you have to separate these three. They need to, you know, be separate from each other. And if the second branch of government, the executive branch, is spying on and knows everything that's being done by the first branch of government, members of the legislative branch, and the third branch, the judiciary, then we no longer have separation of power in the United States. And that means that our constitutional form of government, as envisioned by the founders and established by the Constitution, just isn't there anymore. So it's a really serious issue. of the constitutional division of powers.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
And that's why when Bernie asked the NSA, are you spying on members of the House and Senate? And they basically said, well, no more or less than anybody else in America. That's a pretty shocking answer. And welcome back. Greg, watching us on Free Speech TV in Clarksville, Georgia, on the Dish Network. Hey, Greg, what's up?
Hey, Tom, how you doing? Listen, quickly, I just wanted to throw out there to the university students in Tom Hartman University, is there anybody that knows how you could detect this NSA malware in your recent computer purchase? I thought there might be somebody out there that could, you know.
Are you talking about the story that came through last week about how it was alleged that the NSA had the capability and may have used the capability to intercept computers between the time that they were shipped and the time that they were delivered and inserted malware into them?
That's it, exactly.
Yeah.
And one further thing, if I may mention the White House comment number.
Mm-hmm.
It's 202-456, straight across the dial, 1111.
That's right.
And you can leave a comment that hopefully will get to the president. And, you know, it's an easy thing to do, so everybody try it.
Right. You're right, Greg. And also over at callcongress.org, we've got a little website set up where we've got that number and also the number for the congressional switchboard.
I knew that I was going to mention that.
And there's a couple of toll-free numbers there as well. So, if some people don't know who their member of Congress is. They might know one of their senators. They don't know the other one. You know, those kind of things. And that's fine. You can just call and tell them, here's my zip code, and they'll tell you who your member of Congress is, and then they'll connect you to that person's office. So
Very good. I just wanted to get that out there, and especially if I'm concerned about that NSA.
It's not just the NSA snooping on us that concerns me, Greg. It's I was watching an interview on RTTV this morning with John McAfee, you know, the guy, the McAfee antivirus software inventor. And he said that he read the terms and conditions on the little app that is on his Android phone for his Bank of America account. Now, I don't have Bank of America, so I can't personally attest to this, but nobody ever reads terms and conditions. You just say, yes, I agree to abide by the terms and conditions, and you click the little box and click yes. He said, I actually read them. And he said, in those terms and conditions, it says we have the power to turn the camera on in your phone anytime we want without notifying you. And, he said, you know, there's actually a reason for that. And that is that, you know, if you were to go in and take, you know, $50,000 out of your checking account and then go to the bank and say, it wasn't me, somebody must have stolen my phone, then the bank can say, well, you know, we had your camera on, and it sure does look like you. So, you know, that's why they do it, apparently. I mean, this is what John McAfee said. But if all of that is true, and I've got to download one of these banks' apps just so I can read the terms and conditions, his point was that's how easy it is, basically. It's not just the NSA. To get this kind of stuff into somebody's computer. And plus, you've got all these companies, you know, Google and Amazon and everybody else who are buying and selling your information and keeping track of everything you do and everything you go. And, I mean, you Google something, you search for something on the Internet, and suddenly you've got ads popping up everywhere for that. And it's pretty amazing. It's pretty amazing. I think privacy is damn near dead in America. And time for us to start seriously having a conversation about privacy in America, and that these companies, all this stuff should be opt-in, not opt-out. I mean, first of all, there isn't even an opt-out option, to the best of my knowledge. But it, you know, in every case, they should say, may we track you? And you should be able to say yes or no. We'll be right back. 20 minutes past the hour, Viagra for your brain, the Tom Hartman Program. Welcome back. David in Mukilteo, Washington. Hey, David, what's up? David?
Hello?
You are on the air, sir.
Yes. Oh, well, thanks for taking my call. Well, I think you were a few weeks ago, maybe, you were asking the question as to what a capitalist was or is. Capitalist is anyone that believes in the freedom to trade your labor or invest savings. It's pretty simple. They believe in free markets.
No, not so much.
It, sure.
No. A capitalist is a person who makes their money with capital. A worker is somebody who makes their money with their worker. By working.
Capital is actually not money.
Capital is not always money. No, you're right. You can make your living with owning a whole bunch of apartment buildings, and then people send you money in exchange for that capital. You're absolutely right. Capital can be any kind of asset, but ultimately a capitalist is a person who earns their living by using capital, as opposed to a worker who is a person who earns their living with labor. You have capitalists, you have laborers.
Well, a laborer can be a capitalist. He's working and believes in the capitalist system. And
no, it's not a matter of what you believe in. And there's no, it's not. But you believe in religions, right? What's this believe in capitalism thing? I mean, you know, capitalism is an economic system that has thousands of variations and permutations that are practiced in certainly dozens, if not, you know, I mean, there's roughly 200 countries in the world. There's probably 160 different variations of capitalism practiced in them. And in fact, you can even say that in the United States, we have at least 50 different versions of capitalism. And there's probably 300 or 400 different versions of capitalism in the United States, because every state has different rules about how you can conduct yourself in the world of business, with regard to yourself, with regard to your employees, with regard to regulation of markets, with regard, you know, insurance, whatever it may be. Very often cities have rules that have to do with the use of money. So, you know, capitalism is not something, this is not a religion. It's an economic system that has a set of rules. It's just like football. Do you believe in football or not? You know, come on, give me a break. No, okay, are we going to play touch football or are we going to play tackle football? Are we going to play by NFL rules or are we going to play by high school rules? They're all different. But it's not whether you believe in football or you don't believe in football. That doesn't make you a footballist or a football player. You're a football player if you play football. You're a football, you're a team owner if you make your money owning an NFL team. You're a capitalist if you make your money with capital.
What you just described, there's not a pure capitalist country in... has never been in the
There's no such thing as pure capitalism.
Sure there is.
Describe it to me.
Describe it to you. I just did. It's the freedom of markets. It's anybody that believes in free trade of their labor or their savings or
okay, let's turn this into something real, David. Give me a real life example of a single transaction that would occur in a pure capitalist system.
A single transaction?
Single transaction. I have a pen in my hand. I want to sell this pen to you. Okay? Since you haven't come up with one, I'll create one. I got a pen in my hand. I want to sell this pen to you.
I just came up with one.
Okay.
You just didn't accept it.
Well, what's your example then?
It's in the exchange of goods.
Okay, well, let's take one, because I want to drill deeper into this. Let's take one exchange of goods. I've got a pen. I want to sell it to you. You may or may not want to buy it from me. I convince you that it's a great pen. You want to buy it from me. Is that pure capitalism? Let's say I sell this pen to you for $5.
Well, you don't sell it to me for $5. I exchange something that I worked for to trade it with you. That's just the medium of exchange.
Okay, so, for the purposes of discussion.
We're exchanging.
Right, but for the purposes of discussion, let's say that, you know, you like this pen and I'm offering it to you for $5 and you're willing to buy it for $5 or you're willing
exchanging production for your production.
Okay, let's say you're willing to wash my car in exchange for this pen.
Well, I can do it with a medium of exchange, but it's just a medium of exchange.
Okay.
I'm not really exchanging money. I'm exchanging my labor.
I get it. And that's about as close to pure capitalism as you can get. But what happens if once you get this pen, you discover that it's made with radium and it's burning your fingers, and you know I sold you something that's actually killing you.
Well, I wouldn't purchase from you again, number one. But
okay, so that's the problem with libertarian economics is the solution.
The solution
is always after the harm.
Yeah, what you keep blaming the libertarians is not having a need for a government. Government is there to protect liberty, and if you sell me something that harms my liberty, that's where government steps in.
So there should be a regulation that says this pen cannot be destructive to you.
Correct. Absolutely.
Okay, then those, that regulation is one piece of capitalism. So you're saying right from the get-go that capitalism isn't pure and unregulated. It has to have regulation.
It has to have liberty. It has to have freedom. It's the freedom to trade your labor, and liberty is has to be maintained. Yeah, you can't. Now, that individual would be weeded out, but that's a criminal act.
Well, it's only a criminal act if there's a law against it, and there's only a law against
sure.
it if you're regulating commerce, because this is a commercial activity, selling this pen.
And those laws are put there to protect liberty. Liberty has to be protected. You can't have a plant that pollutes the environment either, because it's affecting the liberty. Libertarians do not believe in no government at all.
Koch brothers have a bunch of plants that pollute the environment. They would like there to be fewer regulations. Let's do away with the EPA.
I don't have anything in with the Koch brothers. If they're polluting the environment, then they should be taken to jail.
Okay. Well, no, because you establish how much you can pollute. Can you get down to zero pollution? You probably can't. So you have to allow a certain amount of pollution because you want the benefit of being able to buy, you know, Georgia-Pacific paper products from them. Anyhow, David, thank you for the call. Hope you.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
If somebody else has a better definition of pure capitalism, I'd love to hear it. Find me. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. It's 28 minutes before the hour, and it's Anything Goes Friday. Charles in Greenville, South Carolina, you have an example of pure capitalism?
Absolutely. I appreciate you having me on the show, by the way.
Thank you for
coming. To be honest with you, it's pretty insightful. Pure capitalism. I fish. My father-in-law hunts. I give him fish. He gives me venison.
Well, that's pure barter.
Pure capitalism.
That's pure barter. But and you could argue that your fish and his venison are both forms of capital that you've acquired through your labor. And
absolutely. Well, it also costs gas, it costs tackle, it costs the cost of my boat
right.
in order to fish.
Right.
And he has to buy bullets and his weapons, et cetera.
Right.
And he has to process a venison. That takes time. And in my mind, that.
Yeah, that's not capitalism, though. That's a barter society.
I don't get compensated from a corporation, but I do work for a corporation, but that's a completely different.
No, yeah. No, if you could figure out a way to take that fish that you got out of the river and
mm-hmm.
and do something with it where it would produce a steady income stream to you for years and years. Let's say, for example, that there was a picture of Jesus on the side of the fish in the scales. And
I'm not really.
No, let me finish
really
this.
Understanding understand where the picture of Jesus comes.
Let me finish my example. Let me finish my sentence, and I think it'll make sense. Let's say you catch a fish and there's a, you know, in the scales on the side of the fish, there's a picture of Jesus. And so you take that fish and you mount it and you put it in a glass case and you put it out on the highway and you charge people $10 a piece and you hire somebody to collect $10 for everybody who wants to go pray in front of the picture of Jesus with the fish that you caught. And there will be people, right? You will have a steady income stream. You'll make $100 a day or $1,000 a day for the rest of your life from that fish. And in that example, that would be an example of capitalism, because that fish has become capital. It's something of value that can generate revenue. But to simply get rid of the fish and trade it for venison, that's just barter.
But your rationale is to say, for capitalism, is to put the fish on a picture of Jesus for some reason.
Because people will pay to see it
display. No,
without consuming it.
What if I turn my fish into jerky for consumption?
Right.
Let's say that I use my smoker,
right.
my wood, which I have to purchase.
Right.
And
then you sell those pieces of fish.
Jerky. And my second question would be this.
Well, hang on just a second, Charles. Let's finish this. If you smoke that fish, or even if you just sold fillets, once you've sold that fish, it's gone. You are not a capitalist. You are a small businessman. You are engaging in free enterprise.
Small business is capitalism.
No, it's not. Small business is not capitalism. I have been running small businesses since I was 16 years old, and I have never in my life been a capitalist. One business I started with a $15,000 investment by a capitalist. There was a fellow down in Atlanta who put up one-third of the money that it took for us to start our travel agency, and he was a professional capitalist. That's all he did was he invested money. And he held on to his stock long after I sold out. My contribution was my sweat equity, my labor, and my wife's. We both worked our butts off for a year or so without any income, and a $10,000 line of credit on my American Express card. So I was not a capitalist. I was using borrowed money. And when we sold that company, we built this travel agency in from 83 to 86 up to a $6 million company, and we sold our share off and retired and moved to Germany. He kept his share and just sold it a couple of years ago. This company has done over $250 million, over $250 million in business since then, and it just got sold to a billion-dollar company. And so his $15,000 investment became probably, I have no idea how much he got for it, but I'm guessing he probably got somewhere in the neighborhood of a million or more for it. And that's capitalism. He was a capitalist. I was an entrepreneur. I was a small businessman. There is a world of difference. I did not make my money waiting for the check from Spraberry Travel, from International Wholesale Travel. I did not make my money waiting for the dividend check to arrive. I showed up at work every day. I took care of people's travel needs. I was a business person. There's a difference.
Well, I understand. That's great. You're a business person.
But I was not a capitalist. I've never been a capitalist.
That you're directly engaged with the capitalist system as a small business person.
No, the only time I've ever been engaged with the capitalist system was that one business where I had a capitalist invest in that business. I've started seven businesses in my life, including this radio show, and we started this radio show with our retirement savings. And none of those have been, with the single exception of the travel agency, I've never had to go to a capitalist for money, and I have never invested money in somebody else's business where I got a passive dividend back. So, no, I'm not a capitalist.
I guess I'm asking, does your radio station have advertisements?
Yes, and it does. It generates cash, and we pay.
System. Yes.
Yes. But that's not the capitalist system either.
You weren't. Well, actually, it is a capitalist system.
No,
you're on the radio.
It is the business
system.
You're
on the radio and you sell advertisements to people who are selling products. That's absolutely part of a capitalist system.
No, it's not.
And my question to you was, and I appreciate your time. You seem like you're a great guy. And it might be a different show or it might be a different segment. But you are absolutely participating in capitalism, and I was just curious if you could point out.
I am not.
Where communism or socialism, if you have radio advertisements that your station gets paid for and you're employed by, that's absolutely capitalism.
Okay, first of all, I'm not employed by any radio station. I own the company. I own the show. So that's about as close to, by your definitions of being a capitalist as you're gonna get. But I'll tell you that I own this business, but I'm not a capitalist. I don't get passive income from it. If I stopped showing up and doing this show, it would cease to exist. There would be
absolutely, but that's what I don't think you're understanding is when you have your talent and
which I'm selling.
What you're doing right now is what you're doing right now when you sell advertising on the air is a core part of capitalism.
No, it's not. And capitalism is making money by investing money. This is like Econ 101. I'm serious, Charles. Just think for a minute. There is a difference between capitalism and business. People can do business in a communist system. People can do business in a socialist system. You can have capitalism, arguably, in a communist system, but probably not. But in a communist system, the government owns the means of production and support and funds everything, right? And in a socialist system, that's a whole different kettle of fish because there's so many different definitions of socialism. But capitalism,
why is there so many different definitions of communism and socialism, but you only have one definitive definition of capitalism
No, there's one definition of communism, okay? It's the state owns the means of production and supply. It's very simple. Okay, Karl Marx laid that out, and you know, from each according to his needs, to each according to his ability, or from each according to his ability, to each according to his needs. That's communism.
I concur.
Capitalism, on the other extreme end, capitalism is a system where people who have wealth invest that wealth, and they make their money passively by having that money make money. Capitalism is making money with capital. In between those two, you've got free enterprise, entrepreneurship, you know, small business, big business, crony capitalism. You got all these, you know, all these variations and dozens of variations. But people who say that they believe in capitalism or that they are capitalists, I mean, you know, unless you make your living sitting on your butt around the pool waiting for the dividend check to arrive every month, you are not a capitalist. Sam Walton wasn't a capitalist. He started Walmart. His children, who are now, you know, in aggregate, the richest, the five of them would be the richest person in the world, they are capitalists because they're making money basically, you know, waiting for the dividend checks to arrive. There is a difference.
Absolutely. Now, all right. Well, I apologize then. I was under the impression, and I guess I use free market / capitalism.
A free market system can have capital in it, or it can not have capital in it. You could have, first of all, I would contest free market, but you could have a market system where everybody owns the business, right? Whether it's an ESOP, an employee stock ownership program, or whether it's a cooperative. That cooperatives don't involve capitalism at all, and yet it's a form of business. Most co-ops that people know about are things like the local health food store, but there are large corporations that are co-ops. There's a cab company in Madison, Wisconsin called Union Cab, one of the best in the country. It's entirely owned by its employees. No capitalism whatsoever, and yet they do lots and lots of business and run millions of dollars through that company. So, you know, it's like America is not a capitalist country, and capitalism is not a religion. Charles, thanks for the call.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
I think part of the mythos of libertarianism is to elevate capitalism to a religion. And welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And whoops, wrong mouse. Corky in Hilton, New York. Hey, Corky, what's on your mind today? Thanks for watching Free Speech TV.
Hello, I was waiting. How long was it going to take you to get around to tell that guy capitalism is you don't do anything, you just use your money.
Right. It's making money with capital, with money.
It took you a long time to get around to it.
I'm sorry, Corky. I'm long-winded today.
All right, I got a question.
I need some more coffee. Okay, go for it.
The Constitution.
Okay.
If it's constitutionally okay for the post office to require that they pay 75 years in benefits, pensions out, right?
Yeah.
They charge them 75
You mean that
years
they set aside money for people who 75 years from now are going to retire? Yes.
Right. Why isn't it constitutional then for us to charge a company that outsources its jobs to charge them 25 years of wages and benefits at 2/3 the rate because they're going to be cheaper overseas,
mm-hmm.
Now, we don't want to take their profits, of course.
You could do both.
So they must pay the employee two-thirds of what he gets in pensions and benefits for 25 years out.
Right. In under our Constitution, the Congress has the power to pass legislation to raise taxes, to spend money, and to regulate commerce between the various states. So anything that involves interstate commerce, Congress can regulate. So and the post office, Article 1, Section 8, I think it's the sixth or seventh paragraph of it, provides Congress with the power to create the post office and roads for it, and which is, you know, what Eisenhower used to create the national highway system. And so the, you know, Congress can has tremendous latitude in what they can do. They can say we're going to require the post office to set aside $5 billion a year and, you know, in a fund to pay for the retirement of people 75 years down the road. And they could arguably say, you know, we're going to change the rules of capitalism or of business in the United States and say that any company that wants to import products from overseas has to set aside 3 years worth of labor costs in a fund someplace. I mean, they could do all of these things. There's nothing that prevents them from doing it other than politics. I mean, you know, Congress would not do that because people would not reelect them.
Well, I've been under the assumption for many years they just want to destroy unions in this country so they can make us the cheap labor for the world.
Well, it's happened. That's happened. Labor costs in America are about half of what they were when Ronald Reagan was president, when you adjusted for inflation. Right now, the average household, which has 1.9 workers in it, the average household is bringing in the same amount of money as the average single worker did when Ronald Reagan was sworn into office. And so, you know, individual labor was $25,000 then, it's $25,000 now. Household income is, or if you were to, adjust for inflation, that $25,000 back then would be about $40,000 now, which is about household income now. So, you know, yeah. But that's... You know, that's the consequence of Reaganomics. And yes, Congress passed all those changes to the rules. We'll be right back. Minutes before the hour. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you, and let's check in with Victoria Jones with the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com, brought to you by goatsfortheoldgoat.com, where you can give a gift of a goat to a returning slave in South Sudan. Victoria, greetings.
Hello, Tom.
Happy Friday.
And to you, too.
Thank you. So what's up? What's going on in the world?
Well, I have so many things. I've got so much. Well, the Obama administration is going to recognize the marriages of more than 1,000 same-sex couples married in Utah before the U.S. Supreme Court issued an order on Monday, effectively halting the practice in that state, according to Attorney General Eric Holder today.
That's great.
So they'll be able to access federal benefits, like the ability to file joint tax returns, while the court's figuring out the validity of the marriages and the court rulings that led to them. It's a bit of a poke in the eye to Governor Gary Herbert of Utah, who's refusing to recognize the same-sex unions.
Yeah.
So it's a bit confusing still.
So a same-sex married couple in Utah is going to have to file a joint return, or can file a joint return with the federal government, but in Utah they're going to have to file separate.
Well, I've been trying to figure this out all day. That's what I would do if I were a same-sex married couple.
Yeah. Yeah, it seems
but
like.
I would also probably get a very good accountant.
Yes, and also get politically active.
That's another thing to do.
This needs to get fixed. What else is up?
The U.S. economy added a meager 74,000 jobs in December.
Mm.
And this is interesting because it really was expected that it was going to add about 196,000 to 200,000 jobs. But some experts are cautioning that wintry weather in many parts of the country may have skewed the data.
Hmm.
which is interesting. Now, the unemployment rate fell to 6.7% from 7% in November, the lowest since November 2008, but it was largely because of people dropping out of the workforce rather than finding jobs.
Yeah, we've gone from 5.6 million missing workers to over 6 million missing workers, haven't we?
Right, and that was of concern. And it was of concern in particular because the people who are leaving are not the older workers in particular, but Julia Coronado, chief United States economist at BNP Paribas, was saying that she was troubled by how many prime age workers were leaving, and there didn't seem to be any particular reason for that different from anything previously, but that was something to be noticed.
Could it be that people are just giving up? I mean, you know, working three jobs and still not being able to keep a household together and just saying, to hell with it, I'm going to move back in with mom and dad?
Yes, could be. Yeah. Could be.
I think that there's a lot of that going on among 20-somethings and maybe even 30-somethings.
I think so.
Which is not good for them, it's not good for their career, and it's not good for the economy. Pardon my interrupting.
It's not. President Obama is going to give a speech next Friday, the 17th, laying out his plans for reforms to U.S. surveillance practices. Jay Carney, the press secretary, said today, no time or location given for the address, which is kind of interesting. It's going to give the administration's response to the surveillance programs that were leaked by former NSA contractor Edward Snowden. So we wouldn't be getting this speech if it wasn't for Edward Snowden. We don't know what reforms he's going to give. He has been considering 46 reforms that were recommended by a review panel, and he's also been taking input from a number of other people. He reviewed things, read a lot of briefing papers during his Hawaii vacation, so we'll hear what he's going to recommend. He may recommend that the metadata from all our phone records is not kept with the NSA, that it's kept with private companies or with the phone companies. That's one possible one. He could recommend that there is a privacy advocate basically representing us at the FISA court. He might recommend that. He's also likely to recommend that there's a crackdown on spying on foreign leaders like Angela Merkel's cell phone. That's one that he's likely to recommend.
Yeah. In fact, I think he's already pretty much said that, hasn't he?
He's pretty much said that, yeah. Target has made new disclosures. Turns out it wasn't 40 million credit card bits of info. It was 70 million.
Oh, my.
And it was names, mailing addresses, phone numbers, or email addresses in addition.
Oh, my.
70 million people.
That's amazing.
I checked to see if I had an account with Target, and I do.
So basically, this is probably anybody who's ever bought from them online or who has shown up in a store and said, yes, I'll take one of those discount cards and put me in your computer kind of thing.
Yes, yes. Yeah, I'm sitting next to the heater that I bought online from them, and they've got all my information, so I've just changed it all. I don't know if it was too late.
Yeah.
And Senate Judiciary Chairman Pat Leahy cited the breach when he reintroduced his data privacy legislation this week, said his committee's going to hold a hearing on the issue early this year. It's interesting that the House passed a law today on data security and Obamacare, and yet Congress has really passed nothing on data security and breaches generally speaking. They just haven't done it.
The House passed a law today?
The House passed a law today, yes.
My goodness. But it was about Obamacare.
It was about Obamacare, yeah.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah, yeah. Sorry. Yeah. Yeah. First Obamacare law of the year, Tom.
Yes.
It's a big deal. First of many.
They haven't named any more post offices after Ronald Reagan?
Oh, they may have already done that.
Yeah.
That I don't know about.
Yeah.
Senate Leader Harry Reid says he's open to considering Republican amendments on the bill extending emergency unemployment benefits through most of 2014. Yesterday, he basically said he wouldn't. So we'll see, with him saying that he's open to it, how that's going to progress with talks over the weekend.
This is a movement in the direction of let's come up with something that the House can swallow.
Possibly, although it's going to be difficult for the House to swallow almost anything because many of them oppose extending unemployment benefits at all.
Many of them oppose the fundamental concept of unemployment benefits.
Correct.
Yeah. Remarkable. Victoria Jones of the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com, brought to you by ghostfortheoldgoat.com. Victoria, great to see you. Thank you.
Thank you.
Happy weekend.
You too.
Thank you. We'll be back with more of Anything Goes Friday here on the Tom Hartman Program in just a second.
You're listening to Tom Hartman.
Hey friends, Tom Hartman here. Thanks so much for watching and listening to the program. The Tom Hartman Program is brought to you in part by the following underwriters. EdisonFactor.com. EdisonFactor is a supplement for the brain. More information at EdisonFactor.com. SolarWorld.com. SolarWorld has a 35-year history in the manufacturing of solar in America. More information at SolarWorld.com. Carbonite.com. Automatic online backup and file recovery. More information at Carbonite.com. AngiesList.com. Detailed reviews on roofers, plumbers, house cleaners, dentists, and more. More information at AngiesList.com. Stamps.com. Postage online from your computer. More information at Stamps.com. And our website, TomHartman.com. You support our programs, and please help by supporting the people who help make this program possible. There are links to all of our underwriters at TomHartman.com. Thank you.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back. Anything Goes Friday here on the Tom Hartman Program. And, the Chris Christie story, just, you know, for what it's worth. The press reviews are in, USA Today saying things like, oh, please. And Christie's hometown newspaper saying, nah, you know, we're not buying this, basically. I mean, not in those exact words. Actually, the exact words are things like the New Jersey Star-Ledger. How can we trust him as a presidential future leader of our country? Question mark. New York Daily News. Self-serving, self-pitying, a brazen cover-up, pathetic. There is a story over at DemocraticUnderground.com, which is where I got those quotes from, that Chris Christie was once asked by a young girl in an audience, a 10-year-old or thereabouts, what was his favorite thing about being governor. And he answered that his favorite thing about governor was that he got to stop traffic. He was talking about the Holland Tunnel or the Hudson Tunnel, whatever it is. He said, you know, they had the Lincoln Tunnel. He said, whenever I go from New Jersey to New York, they completely stop the traffic and empty the tunnel so that the gubernatorial caravan can just go roaring through there. And then he made a joke about how he thinks that that's probably the main reason why his wife wants him to run for re-election, so that they enjoy going to New York City now because it can stop traffic. Bizarre. Anyhow, Harvey in Berkeley. Hey, Harvey, what's up?
Hi, Tom. Well, I feel that we're caught up in a rule by the cruel society and system, and I'd like to share a couple thoughts on the problem.
Sure.
Well, first of all, the repugnant party, you know, they'll extend unemployment, but only if they can cut social programs. Is that cruel? And then, cutting the SNAP program. And at the same time, America exported in 2013 $140 billion in food and agricultural products. That's really cruel. And the question is, are we being ruled by the abused? Remember Romney? You know, in college, he was very abusive. He cut the hair of students who had long hair, other students.
Oh, one particular gay kid, I think it was, that he was going.
And then he put the dog on the roof of the car and drove how many miles,
right,
you know, on the way to Canada on vacation.
Yeah.
I mean, that to me is really cruel. And he would have been our ruler. He would have been in charge. Or is it the economic system at fault? Because, you know, when a person with all the rights of an American becomes broke, loses all their money, they become, a commodity to the legal and the penitentiary system. And then they keep America desperate. They keep Americans down. For instance, you know, whenever we build up public equity, whenever the public builds up wealth, something seems to come along to take it away. We've got the national debt. We got the mortgage bubbles, the sequester. You know, President Obama came in, all of a sudden the banks needed $700 billion. You know, that was going to be the beginning of the renewable energy. And it just seems that whenever there's built, we're kept on our knees. Like, you know, I read articles say 20 per people for 100 people for every job. No one even asks about the salary. And so I think that, you know, that the excess, our wealth is skimmed away so that we're always kept in that kind of like needy position. And I'd like to see commissions across America set up between private citizens, corporations, and members of government and religion to study the reasons that, and come up with solutions.
Well, the reasons are not a secret, Harvey. I just wrote a book about it called The Crash of 2016. These were very intentional policies that were put together over the last 50 years, basically. More or less since 71 when Lewis Powell laid it out in his famous memo, and then it was put into place in 81 when Ronald Reagan took office, and we have been living for the last 33 years now under Reaganomics, you know, with FDR-onomics, New Deal-onomics, New Deal economics have pretty much, you know, they were stopped dead in their tracks in 81 when Reagan busted Patco and began deregulating things like crazy. And then they got reversed. They've been systematically reversed during the Reagan administration, the Bush administration, the Clinton administration, the second Bush administration. And they haven't been reversed quite as quickly during the Obama administration. And in fact, I think, you know, with the stimulus and some other programs, Obama's actually tried to bring back some of the FDR perspective. But you know, you've got so many Republicans in positions of power in the House and the Senate that he's basically incapable of doing anything.
Well, I feel, Tom, that we live in the age of entanglement, of quantum entanglement. We are entangled. We have the Internet. We're all entangled in the Internet. The biggest websites are like Facebook, our personal entanglement websites. And so I think we do have the power, and I think we have the power of boycott. We have the power of divestment. We have the power of the dollar to move things in our way at this program. And I think my motto is, it's nice to be nice, and I say, let's get entangled.
Yeah, well said, Harvey. I'm with you. And I think that the 2014 and 2016 elections are going to hold some real surprises for people. Because I really have this strong sense that people are waking up. And this is the reason why the Republicans are working so hard, state after state after state, to make it difficult for particularly young people to vote, to say that, you know, college ID, even if it's from a state college, which is a state-issued institution, is not valid ID for voting, you know, those kind of things. They're doing everything they can to suppress the vote of people who might vote Democratic. And they've been, you know, quite successful at doing this, and there's a lot more of it coming. Harvey, thanks for the call. Great to hear from you. Scott in Chicago. Hey, Scott, you wanted to talk about capitalism?
Yeah, thank you.
Mm-hmm. Go for it.
Oh, okay. My social studies teacher in high school, he had us play Monopoly. We ended up in five groups,
mm-hmm.
and he's the purest form of capitalism. You're all starting with money to make money. And he called that the $200, everyone thought it was their payday, but he called that Social Security.
Hmm.
And the more money you got, the more you didn't care about your Social Security, the more you didn't worry about landing on your taxes.
Right.
But then the people that were poor and not being so lucky with the dice, they couldn't wait to get that Social Security check.
Right.
And when they had to
pass go and get the $200, you mean?
Right. That's what they called the Social Security check.
Huh.
And then after one person was eliminated from each table, then they got he called them country. So then you could actually loan money to another guy to help defeat, you know, your buddy over there and mess with him. And looking back, that was such a brilliant exercise.
Yeah.
Because he said the only form of capitalism we really have in the U.S.
Yeah. Monopoly, you know, was created by the woman's name. Her first name was Mary. I'm forgetting the rest of her name. But there's a third of a chapter in my book, The Crash of 2016, about the Monopoly game, about the woman who invented it and why. She was a Georgist. She was a follower of Henry George, who was an economist in the early years of the 20th century. And he went off on what are called rentiers, rentiers is how it looks like it would be spelled, people who make money by capitalists, you know, people who make money by rents, by, you know, owning property and just, you know, sitting on that property, sitting on that capital and making revenue from it. And how that ultimately is destructive to society, and how ultimately you end up with a very, very small number of people holding basically everything and everybody else holding nothing. And so she invented this game of Monopoly as a way of, as a warning, you know, as a cautionary tale to say, look out, this is the direction we're going. And that was in the 1920s when we were in the roaring 20s, when we were having deregulated capitalism, because that's what Warren Harding ran for president on in 1920 was less government in business, more business in government. In other words, fewer regulations, more privatization. And he did it. And he dropped the top tax rate from 91% down to 25%. And it set up the Great Crash of 1929, just as Mary, whatever her name was, predicted would happen with the game of Monopoly. That's a great story, Scott. Thanks for calling and sharing. That is absolutely marvelous. 15 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. Anything Goes Friday.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Terror charges faced by Oklahoma fossil fuel protesters. Oh, boy. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And Rob in Sunnyside, New York, watching Free Speech TV. Hey, Rob, what's up?
Hi, Tom. How are you doing?
I'm fine. How are you today?
Yeah, first I want to talk to you about a new type of banker that we need. But before I do that, I'd like to tell you about that fishy venison guy that said he thought you were okay. I think you were great because in my late 20s, I went back to school, fell academically to one knee, and found Hallowell and Rady, got diagnosed, and your ADD success stories and your Edison gene reframed the way I thought about myself and helped pick myself up and get things turned around.
Good on you. Thank you, Rob.
Anyhow, I think that one of my friends, he leads a sangha where I practice. I'm a Buddhist in the tradition of Thich Nhat Hanh. But he has a computer program for a small firm, and they were taking over Alabang, and now he's making like high 30s, low 40s, but he's working 70-hour weeks because he has all these project deadlines that he has to keep working 10-hour days and Sundays, and can't even lead the sangha. I was thinking that, like that previous caller was saying about divestment, there shouldn't be an investment banker. We should have new boutiques and new bankers called divestment bankers that do like the Mondragon thing, like Mr. Wolf was talking about.
Yeah.
You know, and they go in and you have a capitalist or an entrepreneur that has a company, and he or she wants to retire. So they want to get rid of 80% of their net worth, and usually they leverage their company and then invest in stocks. But why not sell 80% of your company to your workers?
Right.
And they have a divestment banker take care of that and turn these companies into worker-owned cooperatives.
There are people who do that, Rob. When Louise and I sold our ad agency in 1997, we sold it to our employees. It was through a lawyer, not through a lawyer drew up the documents for it rather than a banker. But that's not all that uncommon. I mean, I've sold two businesses to my employees.
Had more prevalence because too often that's what's happening. And these Bain type of capitalists or so-called capitalists are just putting the screws to the workers and draining their pension plans and turning them into basically slaves, you know, modern-day slaves.
Yeah. Yeah, well, that's
my friend's on salary, you know.
Yeah, that's the Bain business model. I mean, the Bain business model is you find a company that is profitable, that is doing well, and that is comfortable, and you figure out how hard can you squeeze this company, how uncomfortable can you make them, and they can still produce the good or service and the revenue, and you know they call it cutting the fat, and you know I've Well, I was doing my radio show from a Clear Channel radio station, KPOJ, in Portland, Oregon, when they got taken over by Bain. And what was the first thing that happened was that the people who had been there for 15, 20 years, who were making, you know, 60, 50, 60, 70, 80,000 bucks a year, the high salary people, all got fired. And, you know, replaced with new hires who are coming in at 25, 28, 30, 32 a year, you know, young people, younger people who are willing to work for half as much. And so that's Bain's business model. You squeeze a company as hard as you can, and you load that company with debt. Clear Channel now has, I think, $20 billion in debt or something like that. It's over 10, as I recall, because of this Bain acquisition. And it's just, it's such a shame. It's a sad thing to watch. Rob, thanks for the call. We need more than just a new kind of banker. We need a serious reevaluation of our business models. And to do that, we could start out by just teaching people what capitalism is. Welcome back. Tom Harbin here with you. And that's interesting. Susan in Wana, Washington. Hey, Susan. Thanks for calling. You have a $3,000 deductible on your insurance? Susan? Susan is not listening to her telephone. Okay. Mark Taylor Canfield in Seattle. Hey, Mark. Mark is a writer, reporter, blogger, occupier. Mark, are you there?
Hey, and I just, yes, can you hear me?
I do. So you said that there's a huge turnout for the socialist candidate yesterday. We had her on our show yesterday, didn't we? Yeah.
Yes, I want to thank you for that. And by the way, over the holidays, over December, I was able to take some time off from my journalism. And we recorded a CD of brand new original music, and I have a new book. So as soon as those are published, I will make sure you get them.
Cool. The Mark Taylor Canfield brand extends itself. That's great.
Well, and what's interesting is because of Shama Sawant, our new Socialist City Council member in Seattle, it looks like I'll be writing for an Indian newspaper because the international media is all over her right now. There was Indian media there at her inauguration on Monday. And, you know, one of the things that she was talking about was the way that the corporate power centers have taken over the economy and how the working class has suffered. And that kind of relates to what you were talking about before. And I would just quote David Corton, our local economist here with Yes Magazine, who would say, you know, it would be great if free enterprise existed, but instead mostly what we get these days is monopoly capitalism. So my question is, you know, where's Teddy Roosevelt when we need him?
Right.
But Shama Sawant is definitely caused a brand new grassroots political movement in Seattle. It's totally amazing, Tom. I've never seen anything like this in my life, and I've been covering local politics in Seattle for years. Never seen a crowd like that, never seen an overflow crowd at a city council and mayoral inauguration. They actually had to hold the ceremony in the public lobby, which is a huge area at City Hall.
Wow.
And she had people all over on all of the layers, all of the levels of the lobby holding $15 an hour minimum wage signs. And Joe Higgins, Irish member of parliament, who's also a socialist, was there to speak on her behalf and also gave a speech at her celebration party after the inauguration. But I have never seen anything like this. I mean, she literally brought some people to tears because they've been waiting so long to hear a politician speak up for the working class.
Right.
And the first thing she said after she raised her fist to the crowd was, there will be no backroom deals.
Right.
And also, Tom, to answer your question, I think you asked me once before about whether she is coming across as a social democrat and a European sort of Canadian style. I would say yes.
Yeah.
She's definitely, she's not ranting about Marx. She's talking about corporations and the power.
Yeah, she did. She did on our program. And I think if you wanted to hyper simplify definitions, we could say that the definition of a capitalist is somebody who makes money on capital, and a definition of a capitalist society and political structure is one that protects capital first and protects everything else second. And the definition of socialism is an economic and social system that protects people first and protects capital second. Does that make
it's
sense?
Great to see how, yes, I agree with that. And I think that she's already had a big influence on city politics because every one of those candidates that spoke during the inauguration had to mention $15 an hour minimum wage. They had to mention police accountability, which is an ongoing issue in Seattle where the Justice Department, the U.S. Justice Department, still says that the Seattle Police Department are dragging their feet on civil rights reforms. Mm. So, you know, she's already pushed the local political scene, and it's been amazing to watch the people who felt disenfranchised, as she would describe them, poor, disenfranchised, and oppressed, to see those people, regardless of whether they consider themselves socialists, and I would say that the majority of people who support her in this town probably don't, but they like what she's saying, and she's authentic, and as long as she stays that way, I think she's going to get...
Well, Bernie Sanders calls himself a socialist. I mean, it's not like there's nobody out there using that word. I mean, Bernie doesn't use it a lot, but he doesn't run away from it at all. And, you know, he calls himself a democratic socialist. But
right, and the Alternative Socialist Party, which Shama Sawan is a member of, by the way, it's also amazing that she has a PhD from North Carolina State University and is currently a teacher at Seattle Central Community College, so she's an educator. Mm. But they ran a candidate in Minneapolis, Ty Moore, and he almost won a seat. He came within a few hundred votes of winning a city council seat there. So they are going to use electoral politics as a way to change the political dialogue, and she said from the very beginning that she represents the working class. And Joe Higgins, the Irish member of Parliament, during his speech said, this is not just a local story. Shama Sawant has captured the attention of people all around the world because he's getting calls from all over the place.
Oh, yeah.
South America, Europe, Asia,
It's true. It's true. Mark, thanks a lot for the report. Mark Taylor Canfield from Seattle. Sam in Point Pleasant, West Virginia. Hey, Sam, what's up?
Hey there, Brother Hartman. I hope you're doing well, and Happy New Year.
Thank you. Happy New Year to you, too. I hope you're doing well.
I'm hanging in there, but good. I have a report. I'm, you know, one of them low-key journalists, too, you know, like mm-hmm. that other fella, but not as educated as him. I'm reporting on a state of emergency here in West Virginia. They got a bad chemical leak up the river there. 8 counties is being affected. You can't even take a bath in this water. It's so polluted.
Yeah, I understand. 300,000 people now have polluted drinking water in West Virginia.
They had to close all the restaurants in Charleston, West Virginia, our capital.
Wow.
You can't wash the dishes or nothing. I mean, it's stuff they make Freon with.
Huh.
And they don't know how long it leaked. I mean,
I'm listening, Sam.
Well, see, if they lit a bomb, I'll go ahead and go with them jobs to fix the infrastructure. Maybe that wouldn't have happened. I mean, you know, they detected it. They smelled it.
Wow.
It smelled like licorice.
Wow. Wow.
And then they checked out the smell, and there was a big tank of leaking on the bottom of the tank.
Yeah.
In the Elk River. And now we got to deal with that.
That's amazing.
And greed, just people not wanting to spend out the money.
Yeah, yeah. Sam, thanks a lot for the call. Thanks for pointing that out. I need to dig into that story a little more and report on it myself. In fact, I'm going to go looking or get off during this news break here over the next 6 minutes right now. Because that's my understanding is that there's 300,000 people in West Virginia who literally can't drink their own tap water.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
And this seems like it should be one of the biggest stories in America. We'll be back 28 minutes past the hour. It's called 4-methylcyclohexane, and this is the chemical that is contaminating the water of 300,000 residents of 9 counties in West Virginia. Governor Ray Tomlin has declared a state of emergency. 9/11 received over 1,000 phone calls in the hours after the spill. This was yesterday. It started yesterday afternoon around 4 o'clock. 4 or 5 people transported to the hospital by ambulance. Methocyclohexane methanol, it's called. This is a spill that happened at the West Virginia American Water Company. Nobody's even sure why this chemical was there, because it's apparently not a chemical that you use to treat water. And they're not sure when their water system is going to be back. It got into the river. It might have gotten into the soil. And the river is the source of water for communities downriver. Charleston, this has just been devastating to the people at large and the people who live in our city, said that Danny Jones, the mayor of Charleston. It leaked into the Elk River. And apparently Freedom Industries, the company that manufactures the spilled chemical, has said that the company that spilled this, which is the West Virginia American Water Company, has not been in contact with them. So there's a lot of unanswered questions about this 4-methylcyclohexane, methylcyclohexane methanol and how much of it has spilled into the water and why it was there and what it was doing and how dangerous it is and all kinds of stuff. This is, you know, this is the difference between libertarian capitalism as practiced in the United States to a certain extent and the precautionary principle capitalism as practiced in Europe. I shouldn't even call it capitalism. I should call it business. In the United States, we allow chemicals to be introduced into commerce, and when they start killing people, then we ban them. In Europe, they say, you got a new chemical and you want to expose people to it, whether it's in shampoo or whether it's in food or whatever it may be, prove that it's not harmful. And when you have proved that it's not harmful, then we'll let you put it into the food supply or into the water supply or whatever. The precautionary principle, of course, is much more expensive for business. Sean says that, per MSNBC, that this chemical is used in coal processing. That's interesting. So, anyway. Ashes in Palatine, Illinois. Hey, Ashes, what's up?
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I want to ask you, why do you think workers are so much undervalued and disrespected in this country?
That's a good question. I think in large part because we have a culture of celebrity in America, and wealthy people have become the celebrities. You know, we had Lifestyles of the Rich and Famous and you know, all this conspicuous consumption and, you know, oh, that person is a billionaire and look at this guy. He just, you know, Zuckerberg just, you know, took Facebook public and became a billionaire and the Twitter guys became billionaires and everybody's like kind of bowing down to them and worshiping the ground they walk on. And, oh, does Bill Gates have something to say? We want to listen. And, I think that culture of celebrity associated with wealth and power, one of the reasons it's so prevalent in the United States is because wealth is political power in the United States, far more than in most other countries. The countries of Europe do not allow wealthy people to spend mind-boggling amounts of money on political races, for example. We do here in the United States. So wealth translates into political power, and political power, you know, basically we're reinventing royalty. We're reinventing kingdoms. I think it's a sociological as well as an economic phenomenon. Does that make sense, Ashes?
Yeah. So why do you think that these companies that have workers for them, don't these companies believe that if the workers are not there for them, that the companies won't reap the benefits of all the profits they get from the workers?
Well, when you have a labor market, when you have a tight labor market, that's very much the case. You know, when you have for every job opening, there's one person looking for a job. But because of our trade policies over the last 30 years, we now have a very loose labor market. And this works tremendously to the benefit of conservatives, libertarians, corporations, transnational corporations, manufacturers. Because there are so many more people looking for work than there are jobs, because these big transnational companies have succeeded in moving these jobs offshore, because of that, they've been able to ignore the what would have been the demands of workers and now are just simply the requests of workers. They've been able to ignore that and just, you know, just keep on keeping on, you know, doing whatever they're doing, you know, robbing them of their pension plans and renegotiating deals with them and playing them off one state against the other, like Boeing is doing in Seattle, or was doing recently. So, I see this as This is where government needs to step in. If government had stepped in as the employer of last resort to tighten the labor market, when you've got a tight labor market, workers have power. When you have a weak labor market, employers have power. And
right.
And government can influence that. In fact, you know, Alan Greenspan acknowledged this in my book Screwed, which came out back, I don't know, six, 8 years ago. But I think, you know, it's still a pretty good analysis of what's going on. I talked about how Alan Greenspan famously told the Wall Street Journal that his job, that he could loosen or tighten the labor market by turning up or down interest rates. If he turned up increased interest rates, it would make it harder for businesses to borrow, so businesses would get more cautious, they would not expand as rapidly, and that would cause the economy to slide into a recession. If he lowered interest rates, that would make it very easy for businesses to borrow, they would expand more aggressively, and consumers could borrow as well and buy more product, and that would you know, increase the vibrancy of the marketplace and thus increase the demand for labor. And so he could control the supply of labor relative to the supply to the demand for labor by adjusting interest rates. And given that, his famous quote to the Wall Street Journal was words to the effect of, and I'd have to dig through my own book to find the exact phrase, but words to the effect of, my most important job as chairman of the Fed is to maintain a certain necessary level of worker insecurity.
Right.
So
these companies, they always, every job I've had at various companies here, they pressure their workers to produce so much for them, and then if they don't produce for the company, they just let them go, saying that you didn't produce enough for us, so we're going to let you go.
Right, because there's always somebody else standing in line saying, "I'll take that job," and that's the point. If you've got a loose labor market, then it works tremendously to the advantage of the employer, and this is why I think the government should be the employer of last resort, in order to maintain, you know, the unemployment at a low level. Unemployment should always be below 3%, and it hasn't been since the 1980s, since the 1970s actually. And in fact, it wasn't below 3% then; it was below 4% then. So let's say it should always be below 4%. It was 3.6% in 1980. Jimmy Carter had very low unemployment, and in part it was because he put people to work with programs like CETA. You know, the government did become the employer of last resort to a certain extent. And if government stepped in to maintain a tight labor market by hiring people, by putting people to work, whether it's building bridges or you know, digging holes, I don't care. What it would do is it would change that relationship of that power relationship between employers and employees, and you'd see wages start going up. As wages start going up, it stimulates the economy, because people are buying more things. As people start buying more things, that creates more demand. That would cause more entrepreneurs to come into the marketplace, more business people to say, hey, you know, let's build some more stuff to fulfill this demand, and you get this virtuous cycle. But as long as you've got a loose labor market, you're in this destructive cycle, this downward cycle, and that's what we have been in. I would argue, you know, the there have been bubbles along the way, hiccup bubbles along the way, but basically we have been in that downward spiral since 1981. And, you know, some would say 1978 was actually the year that it began. And the only thing that will reverse it, in my opinion, is if the government intervenes. Ashes, thanks for the call. Mark in Chicago. Hey, Mark, thanks for listening to WCPT. Got a minute to the break. What's up?
Oh, wow. Hey, Tom, I wanted to talk about money.
Okay.
First with Senator Sanders, but I think the most important thing that that people need to understand is who creates money and how it's created. To answer that question, banks create money out of thin air, and they do so every time someone goes into a bank to borrow money.
That's correct.
But that's why I say that banks are not in the business of lending money. They're in the business of creating money.
Yes, and making a profit in doing it. That's how the fractional reserve banking system works.
They create the principal, but they do not create the interest.
That's right. And thus, so it's a game of musical chairs. Eventually, somebody loses.
Yeah. And it's no surprise, then, that banks end up with all the money.
Yeah.
And the people end up with all the debt.
Yep. You're absolutely right. And this is why we have to have state banks that operate on behalf of the people rather than on behalf of the banksters, where all of the profit that comes out of interest, that comes out of a fractional reserve banking system, is put back into the public good. Only one state in the United States has done that, North Dakota. Every other state should be doing it tomorrow morning. Thank you, Mark.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
Ellen Brown has written extensively about this. She has a book called Web of Debt. She's just some brilliant stuff on state banking. Webofdebt.com is her website. Welcome back. 15 minutes before the hour. And there we go. Richard in Sebastopol, California, watching Free Speech TV on the DirecTV system. Hey, Richard, what's up?
Yes, Tom. You know, it's very interesting to hear you talk about the government creating jobs. But in reality, the government doesn't have to create any jobs. All I have to do is put a reasonable tariff rate on all these cheap goods that's coming in from China and the Far East.
I agree.
All these problems started back in the Clinton administration with NAFTA, GATT, most favored nation status for China. And now they're trying to pass the Trans-Pacific Trade Partners, which is another thing that's going to kill manufacturing in this country.
All right, this is the one we should call SHAFTA.
SHAFTA, yes. I mean, how does an American employee or worker compete with 10, 20 cents an hour labor in China? There's just no way to do that. And that's what's happened to our labor force. Now we have, I read some statistics about a year or so ago, 63,000 manufacturing plants have left the country for the Far East.
That's right.
Which translates into about 25 million workers. Now, if you take 25 million workers out of a workforce, you take a huge amount of tax revenue out, income, and no wonder people are having a hard time.
Right. And not only that, when you export manufacturing jobs and replace them with service sector jobs, the lesson that Adam Smith wanted to convey in Wealth of Nations, his 1776, book that's like, Econ 101, the lesson is that the wealth of a nation is what is created by manufacturing. He used the example. He said, if you've got a tree limb sitting on the ground, it has no intrinsic value. If you apply human labor to it and turn it into an axe handle, it now has wealth. It now represents wealth. It has value that can be passed down from generation to generation, in fact. And so as nations make things, they create wealth. Now, when we move and that's manufacturing. We have gone from 35% of our economy being manufacturing to now 11% of our economy being manufacturing. And we've replaced all that manufacturing with service sector jobs. We're basically just moving money back and forth and, from person to person and, constantly exchanging labor for money, but not producing wealth. And it's made our country poorer.
I don't think we've even got the service sector jobs. That was an illusion. That was a promise by Clinton.
Yeah.
We didn't get those jobs either.
Yeah. Well, we were supposed to get the, quote, new economy jobs. Everybody was going to come here because of the Internet, but India is turning out more tech people than we are out of their colleges. And China is starting.
All you have to do is look at the the stock market. The big corporations are making huge profits now because they pay zero for labor.
Yep.
And the Chinese have their own ships to ship all the cheap goods here.
Yep.
I mean, there is no way that America is going to compete with that. I mean, we have to pay our people.
Yeah, no, I agree. We need to go back to a protective trade policy. This is why I wrote a book called Rebooting the American Dream. This was the first chapter. It was on returning to the trade policy that Alexander Hamilton put into place in 1793 in the George Washington administration. Hey, thanks so much to our show director, Louise Hartman, to my executive producer, Sean Taylor, to our associate producers, Shane Farnan and Danielle Gilday, to our video director, Jim Javinsky, to our writer-researchers, Andrew Campbell and Nate Sweet, to Alpha Goldbook for video production, to our webmasters, Nigel Peacock and Jamie Holly, to our business manager, Ron Hartenbaum, to all of the company, all the folks at the various companies that syndicate our program, Westwood One, Pacifica Radio, Sirius XM Satellite Radio, CRN Network, Free Speech TV on Dish Network, DirecTV, all the cable providers who carry our show, Comcast, Manhattan Neighborhood Network, all the others around the country, all the great folks at Free Speech TV and RTTV who work on the big picture, to the Progressive Voices channel on TuneIn, to our newsletter editor, Sue Nethercutt, the folks in our chat room, to Ellen Ratner, Victoria Jones, Bob Ney, and everyone at the Talk Radio News Service, to Jay Goodman-Tamboli for tech support, and to our affiliates, our sponsors, and to you for supporting our program. Thank you. And I think we need to rewrite this. I believe that Cumulus bought Westwood One, didn't they? So now Cumulus syndicates our program. Yeah, oh, it's still Westwood. It's still called Westwood One? Okay, I didn't. I should be paying more attention to these things, I suppose. Yes. But in any case, thank you to all of you for, you know, keeping us on the air and keeping it going. And it being Anything Goes Friday, I will. I just wanted to pull up the New York Times homepage and see if this West Virginia spill was at the top of the news, and I don't see that it is. It's very, very interesting. Instead, it's all about the New Jersey elaborate effort to hide political motive in lane closing. That's the top story. I think 600,000 people not being able to drink their water is a bigger deal than Chris Christie's presidential ambitions, frankly. I mean, we all know he's a bully. You know, he brags about it. He's proud of it. Lawrence in Berkeley. Hey, Lawrence, what's up?
Hey, how you doing? You know, you have the most wonderful analysis on your show, you and your listeners. But I'm most interested in action and how to do things. And I have a slogan which, if used in all meetings, in every meeting, every demonstration, every lecture, could multiply the effective power of the left and of progressives. And it's this: everyone leaves the meeting with a job to do and somebody to do it with.
Hmm.
And the reason that I say that is, you know, I've been going to demonstrations now and meetings and whatnot for 50 years, and they're mostly the same. People come in singly or in groups of two or three, and then they leave in groups of two or three. And it grieves my organizer's soul every time I see that.
Yeah. People, it's almost like it's a, you know, pump you up thing. You know, it's a form of political masturbation, I guess.
Exactly. And pump up the egos of the speakers.
Mm-hmm.
And instead, what is needed is to take some time at the end, you know, there should be shorter speeches or fewer speeches, and say to the crowd, well, there are two ways of doing it. You can have one specific job, for instance, if it's, for one example, if it's registering voters, you say, who lives here? Who lives in that neighborhood?
Yeah.
Okay, great. Who else lives in that neighborhood? And form groups that are going to register people in that neighborhood, and let them go out and do it.
Mm-hmm.
Or in a more general way, you say, I want to know the people in the audience that are interested in doing various kinds of projects. Somebody will say, oh, I'm going to do a labor project, and somebody will say, I'm doing a neighborhood project, or I'm doing a project on women. And then you say, good, everybody who wants to join them and go do it, go out and do it, and then come and report back.
Mm-hmm.
So if you do this, you empower everybody who comes to the meeting. And, you know, if it's a large meeting, the majority of people who are coming are not already activists.
Right.
And this is a way of turning everybody who comes to the meeting into an activist.
You're right. Lawrence, you're describing management 101 for activists.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And, you know, it involves having less ego involvement of the leaders and saying, I don't necessarily want to empower my ego. I want to empower the action ability of everybody here who comes. And if every meeting that we had, by the way, your meetings, you're going to have a book tour now, right?
No, it's about half done. We're going to hit a couple more cities, but it's mostly done. But my meetings are right here on the radio every day, and I end every single day with, you know, democracy's not a spectator sport. Get out there, get active, tag, you're it. I mean,
right.
It's like people can recite that.
Yeah. I mean, there are forms of neighborhood organizing, for example, that are doing this. There's a guy in my neighborhood who on a website is publishing all the various different group activities that are happening in the neighborhood, and people can go to them.
Yeah, that's great. Yeah, there was a fellow when we were living in Portland who was putting together a website just like that. Lawrence, I only have a couple of minutes before the show is over. I want to get another call in. Thank you. That was brilliant. Pat in Beloit, Wisconsin. Hey, Pat, what's up?
Hi, Pat. No.
Hi, Tom. I'm Pat.
Yeah. I just wanted to – we use it in our social studies classes at the high school, and it's a large high school, and our staff is fairly progressive in that we want to inform people. Mm-hmm. And the website to go through is through Google and look up Wealth Inequality America.
Okay.
And it's all about a five-minute thing about the graphs and what we think most Americans think wealth is.
Oh, yeah.
But it's an excellent vision. And a visual is sometimes more effective than just oral.
I agree. Have you seen Robert Reich's new movie on inequality?
No, I have not.
Oh, it is so worth seeing. It hasn't come to my area, is the reason I have not seen it yet.
But I just want to recommend this site because it makes it so graphic to see.
Okay.
And I think that we're educating the youth of America by showing them that video.
Wealth Inequality America.
Wealth Inequality.
Search on those terms. Okay, we'll do it. Pat, thank you very much for the call, and thanks so much for listening to the program. Coming up Monday, the battle on minimum wage. Should you make more or less based on your age? Seriously, some right-wingers think that a sliding pay-per-age scale is a good idea. Dr. Peter Schiff, conservative talker, and all the news and information. And don't forget, democracy is not a spectator sport. It really does require you. Tag your it. Get out there. Get active. Occupy something. We'll see you on Monday. Have a great week.
You've been listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, go to TomHartman.com.
Hey friends, Tom Hartman here. Thanks so much for watching and listening to the program. The Tom Hartman program is brought to you in part by the following underwriters. EdisonFactor.com. Edison Factor is a supplement for the brain. More information at EdisonFactor.com. SolarWorld.com. SolarWorld has a 35-year history in the manufacturing of solar in America. More information at SolarWorld.com. Carbonite.com. Automatic online backup and file recovery. More information at Carbonite.com. AngiesList.com. Detailed reviews on roofers, plumbers, house cleaners, dentists, and more. More information at AngiesList.com. Stamps.com. Postage online from your computer. More information at Stamps.com. And our website, TomHartman.com. You support our programs, and please help by supporting the people who help make this program possible. There are links to all of our underwriters at TomHartman.com. Thank you.